Greetings, this is Tyler McFeeters with your News Gazette, dated Friday, June 5th, 2026. We'll begin today's reading on the front page with an article headlined, Going Once, Going Twice. Building's contents auctioned off in to clear way for demolition start Monday. Story by Luke Taylor, out of Arthur. It was an Everything Must Go sale at the Arthur Lovington Atwood Hammond High School this week, when just about anything from the building that could be carried out was auctioned off. Basketballs, backboards, lockers, an industrial oven, if it wasn't bolted down, it was available to the highest bidder. I got the time if you got the money, auctioneer Owen Gingerich called out, showing a box of clocks to a crowd of at least 100 gathered on the basketball court bleachers. He tapped his fingers on the bottom of a large metal bowl. A mixing bowl or drum, whatever you want to do with it. Whether you just wanted something useful at a good price or were looking to capture some memory from the high school building, folks wandered among items gathered in the gym and then throughout the entire school, moving room to room as furniture was auctioned off. Starting Monday, the building comes down, said Arthur CUSD Superintendent Shannon Cheek during Wednesday's auction. Parts of this school have been here for over 100 years. While there had been talks of trying to demolish this school and build the incoming new one in phases, Cheek said that the district is saving something like $5 million and a year of work time by having high school students go to Lovington for a year, while Lovington grade school kids come to Arthur. Decisions like this are never easy, Cheek said. I do want to give our board a shout-out, and I want to give them a lot of credit for making the decision that is in the best interests of our kids in the long run. It was not an easy decision to do this, and it took a lot of courage. Dawn Redfern, who works as an administrative assistant to the high school, came out to the auction. She said she'd been watching teachers move items out of the building all year, with administration giving guidelines on when to move what. Teachers had to decide what to auction off and what to keep for the new school. It kind of hit hard when you see the fence around the school and the trailers out in the lot, you know, Redfern said. Still, she's excited for the new school. She's excited to have air conditioning, too. Redfern wasn't worried about picking up any memorabilia at the auction. She and the other staff received keychains with photos of themselves at the school from Principal Stephanie Siegmiller. That was the most important piece that I took away at the end of the year, she said. Martha Yackel turned up at the auction because her family's history with the high school building goes way back to when her parents graduated in 1946. She and her siblings went to that same high school, as did her children and grandchildren. Sally McCarthy was there for similar reasons. Her husband coached football and track at the school for 56 years, and her son attended ALAH. Both are focused on the positives of getting a new school building, but still have many important memories at the old one. They've done such a good job trying to maintain it, but you get to a point, the old boiler, they've been babysitting that since we were in school, Yackel said. Even without kids or other family members currently involved in the school, both ladies say they get out to sports games and other events just to be involved in the community and be supportive. The school is just the heart of the community. It does make a big difference, and we've been very fortunate, and I think it's going to get even better, McCarthy said. And then there are numerous pictures of the school interior and various items on a gym floor. Also on the front page is Balloons Over Vermilion, Time to Soar. A balloon takes flight at the Lake Vermilion Dam on Thursday afternoon during the Splash and Dash event preceding today's official start of the Balloons Over Vermilion Festival at Kennecook County Park in Danville. The festival begins at 3 p.m. today and continues through Saturday, weather permitting. And then there's a gallery for visiting. If you visit newsgazette.com, it has photos from balloon festivals past and present. And then the final story on the front page is federal indictment. County's chief deputy circuit clerk faces 3 fraud charges. Ammons allegedly got jobless benefits while on county board. Story by Luke Taylor out of Urbana. A former Champaign County board member has been indicted on federal charges accusing her of accepting unemployment benefits while holding that position. Titiana Ammons has been charged with 3 counts of defrauding the U.S. Department of Labor and the Illinois Department of Employment Security from October 2020 to October 2021. The indictment alleges that she applied for and received unemployment benefits from around October 24th to 2020 through around September 10th, 2021. Starting in January 2021, those benefits included around $300 extra per week in connection with an emergency proclamation from then-President Donald Trump concerning the COVID-19 pandemic. According to a release from the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Central District of Illinois, during the time she was receiving unemployment, Ammons worked for and received money from various entities, including as an elected District 11 representative on the county board. Ammons, who is the daughter of State Representative Carol Ammons, Democrat of Urbana, and Champaign County Clerk and Recorder Aaron Ammons, was elected to the county board in 2020 after running unopposed for the District 11 seat. She resigned from the board effective August 10, 2021, saying at the time that she was leaving due to her health and a desire to spend more time with her family. According to her LinkedIn profile, she has been employed as the Chief Deputy Circuit Clerk in Champaign County since January. Previous roles included Director of Operations at the Bridgewater Sullivan Community Life Center and Administrative Clerk at an Illinois Secretary of State Driver Services facility. During the time she was on the county board, Ammons also worked as an executive assistant for HV Neighborhood Transformation, an agency working to combat gun violence. However, prosecutors said she told the state employment agency that she did not work and did not receive any wages, and as a result, she received unemployment benefits to which she wasn't entitled. Ammons was served with a summons to appear in federal court on June 11th. If convicted of any of the 3 counts of wire fraud, she could face up to 30 years imprisonment and a maximum $1 million fine, alongside restitution. The investigation was conducted by the FBI's Springfield office and the U.S. Department of Labor's Office of Inspector General, and is being prosecuted by Assistant U.S. Attorney Eugene Miller. And turning now to national and world news, U.S. Congress. Senate rejects first effort to bar $1.8 billion settlement fund. Dems also plan to force votes on Trump tax audit immunity. Story out of Washington in the AP. Senate Republicans cleared the first hurdle Thursday as they struggled to pass legislation to fund President Donald Trump's immigration enforcement agencies, narrowly beating back a Democratic effort to permanently block Trump from creating a $1.776 billion settlement fund for payouts to allies who claim they were persecuted by the government. Republicans still face a gauntlet of Democratic amendments before the bill can advance, setting up a day-long test of party unity. More votes on the settlement fund are planned, including proposals from Republicans, and it was unclear if GOP leaders would be able to fend them all off and pass the legislation. "I can't predict how it comes out," Senate Majority Leader John Thune told reporters between discussions with some of the holdouts off the Senate floor. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer said that Democrats plan to force votes on the tax immunity granted to Trump as part of the settlement and a host of other issues, including Trump's East Wing ballroom project, his tariffs, his war with Iran, and his immigration enforcement campaign. Amendment after amendment, vote after vote, Republicans are going to have to answer to the American people, Schumer said. Acting Attorney General Todd Blanche said this week that the fund would not move forward, and many GOP senators said Wednesday that they were satisfied with his remarks. Yet Trump, who has been at odds with Senate Republicans in recent weeks, raised new doubts about the settlement's future Wednesday afternoon, just after the Senate had voted to start debate on the immigration bill, when he told reporters that it is very important and said, "I don't know whether it is dead or on hold. I'd have to ask the lawyers," he said. Republican Senators Bill Cassidy of Louisiana, John Husted of Ohio, and Dan Sullivan of Alaska held out for around 3 hours on the Democratic amendment banning the settlement amid discussions over whether to vote for it. Cassidy, who eventually voted against the amendment, lost re-election in a GOP primary 2 weeks ago after Trump endorsed his opponent. Husted and Sullivan, who voted against it, are both up for re-election in November. Senators then defeated a second amendment from Republican Senator Tom Tillis of North Carolina that would also ban the settlement fund, but would move the money to a separate anti-fraud fund at the Department of Justice. Most Democrats voted against the amendment, guaranteeing its defeat, but more than 10 Republicans supported it. If Blanche says this is largely inoperative, why not use this moment to codify that, Tillis said ahead of the vote. Otherwise, you're exposing every one of our members who are in cycle to have to deal with this between today and Election Day, and that makes no sense for something that the DOJ says they're not moving forward with. It was unclear how Republicans would vote on additional amendments. Cassidy is also planning to offer an additional attempt to curb the fund, and he appeared to be in conversations with a Senate parliamentarian throughout the morning as he brought her proposals to review. And then also in Mideast conflict, Hezbollah rejects ceasefire deal as Israeli strike kills four. Out of Beirut in the AP. Hezbollah on Thursday rejected the latest ceasefire agreement between Israel and the Lebanese government, and the militant group demanded a complete Israeli withdrawal from Lebanon as more fighting there hampered efforts to end the Iran war. The Hezbollah announcement came as Israeli strikes killed at least four people, according to local authorities, and a UN peacekeeper was killed in the crossfire. An Israeli soldier was also killed in combat in southern Lebanon. Hezbollah leader Naim Qassem, in a written statement read on TV, called the negotiations absurd, humiliating, and insulting. He said the agreement's demand that Hezbollah fighters leave southern Lebanon under fire would mean surrender, defeat, and achieving the enemy's goals. What we are concerned about is an end to the aggression, ceasefire, and Israel's withdrawal, he said, underscoring that Hezbollah has not made any commitment to stop fighting. So long as our villages are not safe and are being bombed and destroyed and our people are killed, he said, northern Israel will not be safe. Following Qassem's statement, drone alert sirens sounded in several border communities in northern Israel, including Shlomi, a town where Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and several ministers had been meeting with local officials, his office said. Israeli media reported that Netanyahu left a short time before the alert sounded. The Israeli military later said the sirens were triggered by attempts to intercept several drones that hit near soldiers in southern Lebanon. No injuries were reported. And the next story in national and world news is U.S. Supreme Court. Justices uphold federal regulators' authority to enforce data privacy laws. A story out of Washington in the AP. The Supreme Court sided with the Trump administration Thursday in upholding the power of federal regulators to enforce data privacy laws on telecommunications companies. The 8-1 decision preserved one of the Federal Communications Commission's key tools, though the companies also won a concession from the Republican administration that could shift the regulatory landscape. The appeal from telecommunications giants Verizon and AT&T challenged a combined $100 million in penalties imposed after the agency determined the companies had failed to safeguard customer location data. The companies argued that the FCC's process was unconstitutional because it gave them little opportunity to tell their side of the story in front of a jury. The administration defended the fines as an essential regulatory tool, but the government also said companies did not have to pay the penalties right away, a regulatory shift in the company's favor. Justices agreed, affirming the FCC's power to order fines when challenges are still available. The orders at issue did not settle the carrier's legal obligations because, stated simply, they did not create an obligation to pay, Chief Justice John Roberts wrote for the majority. And then the next section is Our Communities, which starts out with the On the Town, an occasional photo spotlight from an area event. Today, the League of Women Voters of Champaign County's annual meeting, May 21st at Lincolnshire Fields Country Club in Champaign. The League of Women Voters of Champaign County gathered for their annual meeting May 21st at Lincolnshire Fields Country Club in Champaign. A social hour preceded the business meeting. A group of esteemed 50-plus year League members were recognized along with President Emerita Tricia Crowley. University of Illinois Law Professor Bill Watson presented an enlightening program on the rule of law in 2026. And then there's some pictures from the event. There's a batch of people standing in front of a sign that says Making Democracy Work. There's President Emerita Tricia Crowley was recognized for her lasting impact on the League that includes record growth in membership and expansion of outreach, advocacy, and voter education efforts. And then, let's see, there's a batch of the elected officers and then people chatting at a table. There's another one with the midterm election less than 6 months away, President Jane Santagrossi challenged members to be informed and engaged in the League's nonpartisan mission of making democracy work. Then another picture shows 80 League members and guests gathered for the meeting, the largest attendance in recent memory, and a testimony to member interest in supporting its work to encourage informed and active participation in government. And turning now to, still in our communities, immigration. Chicago U.S. Attorney defends meddling with grand jury process over protest case. Story by Ed White and the Associated Press. The top federal prosecutor in Chicago said he made a personal pitch to a grand jury before it indicted protesters who opposed the Trump administration's immigration sweeps last year. It is a rare admission of his role in a secretive process that hadn't been playing out like the government wanted. U.S. Attorney Andrew Boutros released a 5-page statement Tuesday with transcript excerpts in response to claims by defense lawyers that he had unusual personal contact with the grand jury last October before an indictment was handed up on a third try. He said he appeared solely to remind jurors of their obligation to be fair and said he wasn't presenting evidence or trying to sway them. But Boutros also told jurors to please raise your hand if they cannot set aside their personal feelings about immigration or any other case. It was at a time when President Donald Trump's Justice Department was struggling elsewhere with grand juries. It's not normal, Sol Weisenberg, a former federal prosecutor, said Wednesday. Typically, it's a judge who might make remarks. The government's case against the protesters has fallen apart for other reasons. Boutros dropped charges against 4 activists on May 21st due to alleged misconduct by an assistant U.S. attorney during the grand jury process. There also were claims that jurors who disagreed with returning an indictment were prevented from participating. When the case was dismissed, Boutros told a judge, "No one acted with the intent to mislead, Your Honor." The grand jury process. A federal grand jury has 16 to 23 people who meet in private. A prosecutor presents evidence, and there isn't a role for a defense lawyer. The grand jury doesn't need to make a unanimous decision, though 12 votes are necessary for an indictment. The jurors are sworn to secrecy, along with prosecutors and investigators. It is uncommon for a U.S. attorney in a major city to appear in the grand jury room. Boutros said he didn't speak to jurors about how to apply the law or the evidence against the protesters at a Chicago-area immigration detention site,
Rather, he suggested that he was there simply to give a pep talk while his staff handled the details of the case. Boutros' office said a grand jury unwilling to receive evidence impartially without fear or favor is a threat to enforcing the law. In such uncharted and unprecedented circumstances, extraordinary measures may be required to restore the rule of law, the report states. A defense attorney in the case, Josh Herman, is troubled by Boutros' role. He said it's chilling that Boutros asked jurors to identify themselves if they couldn't put aside their personal feelings when hearing evidence in certain cases before the grand jury returned an indictment on the third attempt. The fact that the indictment has now been dismissed due to other misconduct before the grand jury does not cure the many wrongs that happened here, said Herman, who, with other attorneys, is asking a judge to order the government to pay their fees. Other cases that Trump's DOJ has fumbled. The Chicago case is part of a pattern of the Justice Department during the second Trump administration struggling with grand juries. A panel of judges in Wyoming recently dismissed charges against 9 people after the U.S. attorney there told jurors that the accused were bad guys and murderers. He handed out business cards and invited them to reach out individually to him. In November, a federal magistrate judge scolded a Trump loyalist who secured an indictment against former FBI Director James Comey, saying Lindsey Halligan had engaged in a disturbing pattern of profound investigative missteps. The irregularities have been cited by lawyers who are seeking grand jury transcripts in the case against independent journalist Don Lemon. He is charged in connection with an immigration enforcement protest at a Minnesota church. Boutros was appointed U.S. Attorney in 2025 for Northern Illinois by the Justice Department, a role that was extended last year by judges at U.S. District Court. U.S. Senators Dick Durbin and Tammy Duckworth, both Illinois Democrats, have called for him to resign, citing chaos and deep internal dysfunction in his office. And next in our communities, Urbana Historic Preservation Commission. Landmark status recommended for Civic Center. City Council will make final decision. Story by Jana Wiersema. Out of Urbana. A proposal to designate the former Urbana Civic Center as a local historic landmark is headed to the City Council amid ongoing debates about whether the status would impede the Champaign-Urbana Mass Transit District's plans to build a bus transfer station at the site. The Urbana Historic Preservation Commission voted 4-1 Wednesday to recommend that the Council approve Phyllis Winters Williams' landmark application for the building at 108 East Water Street. Commission member Trent Shepard was the lone no vote. David Hayes, vice chair of the commission, cited a number of criteria in his motion to recommend approval, including the building's architectural significance and how it is an established and familiar visual feature in the community. Nobody has yet convinced me that it is reasonable to spend a lot of money to demolish an asset that has huge adaptive reuse potential, that I happen to think, having just been in there, is in a remarkably good condition, actually, he said. Additionally, Chair Angela Urban stated that the Commission's job is to make a recommendation based on the landmark criteria, rather than potential development of the site. To that point, Shepard says that his vote was due to his doubts about whether the Civic Center fulfilled any of the proposed criteria, including significant value as part of the architectural, artistic, civic, cultural, economic, educational, ethnic, political, or social heritage of the nation, state, or community. Did the Civic Center shape the civic life of Urbana, he said? I can't convince myself that it did. If a building is designated as a local historic landmark, any exterior renovations that affect its architectural character would require a certificate of appropriateness or economic hardship from the city, per the zoning ordinance. The landmark request comes as the MTD hopes to buy the property from the city and build a bus transfer station at the site, with the development including space that could be leased or sold as condos to other public entities. According to Managing Director Carl Gnatt, The transit district has had talks with the Urbana School District about moving its central office to the proposed facility. While Winters, Williams, and others have suggested that the Civic Center building could be incorporated into the project, Gnatt said in a previous interview that keeping the structure would impede vehicle circulation on the site. This was disputed by some commission members. Hayes suggested that a workable circulation plan could involve demolishing the kitchen annex and keeping the larger building. And Dennis Roberts said the large parking lot east of the center could be utilized as part of the MTD's project. The Urbana Civic Center was designed by Smith Seton Olak Architects and opened in 1970, city planner Kate Himlick wrote in a report to the commission. The city closed the Civic Center in 2018. Then-Mayor Diane Marlin said the structure had deteriorated to the point where it would cost $750,000 to $1 million to repair. Additionally, the center's expenses exceeded its revenue by $40,000 to $50,000 on an annual basis, she said. Marlin was one of several community members who spoke during the time for public comment. She was among those who urged the commission not to approve the application. The former mayor said she has been part of several different community attempts to locate a bus transfer station downtown, and the MTD's current proposal for the Civic Center site gets us closer than we've ever been to achieving that goal. I urge this body to prioritize the overall community benefit, and there are many other options for event and meeting places in our downtown, and they are present now, she said. But in reality, there are no other options for the transit center that we so desperately need. Additionally, former MTD trustee Paul Debevic cited the building's maintenance and repair needs, though some members of the public and the commission felt that the structure is in decent condition given its age. People are questioning what's left of the building rather than what it can do for the city of Urbana, said resident Madison Bowman. I'm not saying adapting and or landmarking the Civic Center is a clean solution, but demolishing it represents a loss for education, cultural, and civic value. I've worked in forensic engineering and architecture. I have worked in historical preservation. I have worked on nominations. It's not easy. It requires a lot of work and effort, but I firmly believe the Urbana Civic Center is not just an architectural oddity, but also a chance at Urbana renewal. It was available for everyone, Winters Williams told the commission. For black congregations, for small congregations, for startup churches, the Civic Center was a viable opportunity, an affordable place where they could spread their wings. She also noted that the center was the site of candidacy announcements and political debates, among other events. And we'll take a short break now and return with the second half of our News Gazette, dated Friday, June 5th, 2026. Please stay tuned.